Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP Monthly Training Series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Child Welfare Federal Law Overview presentation. This afternoon, we have Margaret Burt with us, who is an attorney who specializes in the representation of children, adults, and child welfare agencies in trial court and appellate practice, and she will provide an overview of federal child welfare laws. Working in the child welfare arena requires all legal professionals to be educated and informed about federal statutes and requirements. So this presentation will focus on these federal laws. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi there, everybody. I hope that the weather there is pleasant. It is for me here in upstate New York. I practice child welfare law here in upstate New York. I'm not an expert, as many of you are, I'm sure, in your state law, but I do know about federal child welfare law, and that's what we're going to cover today. And if you want to take a look at screen two, and I will refer to each of my PowerPoint screens by number so you can keep up, I have a list for you of alphabet soup of the child welfare law that comes in from the federal courts. Starting back in the 70s and going all the way up until this year, we have lots and lots of federal law. I've highlighted for you in red the ones I intend to go over in a little bit more detail, because these are the ones that are really connected to the day-to-day practice of child welfare in the courts and for those of you who are agency folks listening. But I've also listed them by chronological order. I'm going to actually start by talking about CAPTA, the first one, and I'm going to skip over ICWA and MEPA. You'll see those two highlighted in red, and leave them to the end. They're very detailed, and I've given you very detailed PowerPoint screens on them. I suspect we will not have time to reach the details of them, but I wanted to be able to share with you that level of detail, and we'll probably have some time for some questions. So if you click on your third PowerPoint screen, I want to talk about why this federal law is important to those of us who practice in the child welfare world. Back when I went to law school in the dark ages, nothing about child welfare law, well, nothing about family law, but certainly nothing about child welfare law had anything to do with the feds. It was completely state law. But gradually, starting in the 70s and certainly almost yearly now, the federal government has inserted itself more and more into the actual detail of child welfare law. I tell people that it's one reason that I'm able to do what I do, which is go around the country and do training, even though I may not be an expert in state law, because there's so much of our child welfare law now that's really directed by the federal law that we are really practicing very similarly in a lot of states. To those of us in the trenches, we really want to know, how does this affect our day-to-day interaction with our families and our court practice? And that's what I want to concentrate on here. We hear this slang. We all use it sometimes. The courts use it. Sometimes people don't even know where it's from. The slang of 4E and 4B. You'll see it written there. It's Roman numerals, not numbers. And it refers to, it references actually, sections in Social Security law, federal Social Security law, that allows for some reimbursement for e-money, being very large amounts of reimbursement that states get for foster care funding. So when people are talking about 4E and 4B, they're talking about their concerns that the federal government has set certain rules out in order to receive their money. Isn't that the way these things go? You want somebody's money, you have to follow the rules about it. And so over the years, the federal government has become more and more involved in the intricacies of what happens in our child welfare cases by imposing certain rules and basically threatening or in some cases actually withholding federal funding if those rules aren't applied. Now, I don't want to make it sound like the feds are some evil folks. This is motivated from their perspective on what they believe is good child welfare policy. So starting in the 70s, when they stuck their toe in the water on this on these issues, they decided they wanted to see certain policies regarding both child welfare, safety issues, child protective issues, and then more and more lately in the child welfare issues of permanency and foster care placement. So let's take a look at page 4, screen 4, and we're starting with the first big toe in the water, which was CAPTA. CAPTA started in 1974, and it still exists, and it focuses really very much on broad-scale requirements in the CPS area. It's the first time the feds say, hey, this whole child protective scene, we need to get involved in it. We want to see states do things in a certain way. And you'll see on your screen 4, excuse me, on your screen 5, that there were originally 10 CAPTA requirements in 1974. I've listed them there. Little check mark shows you that in some format they're still in CAPTA today. But it was, going back in 74, particularly issues regarding reporting, issues regarding who's in court, confidentiality started there. And then what I have for you on the following screens in CAPTA, this would be now on screen, starting on screen 6, there are now 28 different requirements out of CAPTA, having built up over the years, almost triple what they started with, all focusing on, again, sort of the state setup for how child welfare needs to look. And if you take a look at 6 and you take a look at 7, on to 8, on to 9, and on to 10, you will see things that are not really, I think, any big surprise for you. These are things that have been around for a long time, and they're larger scale things that the federal government requires the state system to have. So essentially, you can take a look at all of those things. I don't think anything in there is surprising, and much of it has to do with ongoing and updating it as we have had various changes in the system itself. On to page 11, screen 11, you'll see, for example, things coming now into unaccompanied youth coming over the border, getting involved in more preventive actions as well, all included in CAPTA. Really, starting with screen 12, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, that's when those of us in day-to-day practice, particularly attorneys and judges in the courts, that's when we really started to see not just larger picture items from the point of view of the state setup for child protection, but really into the detail of what happens in the courts and what happens in cases. And the Adoption and Safe Families Act, or ASFA, really was a watershed moment for all of us. I vividly recall seeing it for the first time and reading it and just literally being shocked at the level of detail that the federal government was now going to be getting involved in and really making sure that the 4B and the 4E monies would not be shared, that they would literally be at risk. Those monies pretty much drive the whole state system if these rules weren't applied. So Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed in November of 1997. It famously was the last piece of legislation in that year. And then many states came forward to pass what they needed to pass. Every state had to pass substantial law to come into compliance. And that took some states as long as 2 years before it happened. And then, as often is the case with the feds, they come out with the regulations. The regulations didn't come out till 2000. I don't know. I don't really, of course, operate on this level, but I've always thought to myself that the feds kind of have this pattern where they issue these sweeping laws. We all kind of scramble to change our state law and our state system to catch up with it. And then after that's happened, they issue the regulations, I think sometimes in response to the various problems they're starting to see with the statute. So many people had to scramble again after the spring of 2000 when the regs went into place, which sort of, you know, changed a little bit what we thought the feds were asking us to do in ASFA. So starting now on your screen 13, looking over some of the details coming from ASFA, many of this, much of this information I'm now going to cover with ASFA should be really well known by many of your practitioners, but it's a good overview. One thing the federal government required, and you'll see on each of my screens here on ASFA that I have federal references for you, both the statutory references as well as their ultimate regulation references, in case there are attorneys or judges that want to look at more detail. One of the first requirements was what the federal government called reasonable efforts regarding removal. In essence, the federal government said, we want the court to determine that the agency is doing its job. And if the court determines that the agency tried reasonably to prevent children from coming into care, but that there was no way to do that safely, that then the money, the federal money, would flow. In essence, the federal government said, we don't want states to just be responding to child welfare concerns with a knee-jerk placement of a child in foster care. We want to make sure they're trying reasonably to keep the child out of care. And so this requirement that the courts were to review what the fed, what the local district did, what the local state did to try to prevent the foster care placement. Now, obviously, this is happening when the court is actually doing the foster care placement. So in essence, the court is looking at what didn't work. The idea being that if the court said, you didn't try hard enough, it may be unsafe, it may be at such a level of risk, such imminent danger to the child, that I'm going to place this child out of the home, but I'm going to say that you didn't try hard enough, agency, and that would cut the money off. This one's a very serious one, because if this one happens and the court says, no, you didn't do it, I'm cutting the money off, or the court forgets to do this and it isn't in the court order, then there will be no money for this child's placement for their entire placement. You'll see on screen 14 some of the things that the reasonable efforts to prevent placement, sometimes called the RE, really consist of, making sure that this has all happened before the request to remove the child. Although, hyper-technically, the feds allow the court 60 days to make the finding, that's not 60 days to do the work. The work has to have been done before the placement of the child in foster care, again, for the federal 4E dollars to flow to the child. If you look at page 15, screen 15, you'll see that I'm commenting here that the phrase reasonable efforts is used twice by the federal government. The one I'm referring to now is the reasonable efforts finding that has to be made before the child, efforts made before the child came into care to try to prevent care. But they also used the same phrase, somewhat confusingly, to refer to the efforts the court then had to find at an ongoing time frame when the child was in foster care, reasonable efforts to achieve the child's permanency plan in, at that point in time, the newly created concept of permanency hearings. So on page 16, you will see some of the suggestions I have for the kinds of things the courts could be looking at to determine that reasonable efforts were made to prevent placement. And again, a few more on 17. If you move to screen 18, I've made a comment there about the fact that there are cases where there may have been no efforts made at all because the situation was urgent, an emergency situation, probably in a case where the family had never been known to the agency before, a child's badly injured, or a situation where parents are being arrested for running a meth lab and no one knew about the situation and the children are going into care right away. The court can make a finding that there were no efforts that could have been reasonably made. That's not the same as you didn't make them. This is a determination that there were none to make. And we also have a requirement under ASFA for the court to make a decision that the placement in foster care or the placement outside of the home is in the child's best interests, or alternatively, either language could be used, that it's contrary to the child's welfare to remain at home. This concept didn't seem so foreign to us when this passed with ASFA in the 90s, because it's really sort of very akin to the concept in most state law that the judge has to make a determination that the risk to the child at home is so serious that the child child needs to be taken away from the parents, and usually on a level that would be seen appropriately constitutional. But this needs to be clearly stated, and the language the federal government is looking for is that it is contrary to the child's welfare to remain at home and or in the child's best interest to be placed outside of the home. And you'll see on screen 20 that this is required regardless of what kind of removal we're talking about. This could be detention. This could be a situation where the child is being placed with a relative who's not yet being made a foster parent. And it does have to be case by case with very specific detail, either in the order or referencing a document that has specific detail. You'll see on screen 21 that this contrary to the welfare finding must be made in the first court order that sanctions the child's removal from the home. It has to be detailed, and again, if it is not made, this particular finding is not made, it cannot be fixed. The child simply will pull in no federal dollars for their entire stay in foster care. You'll see on screen 22 the second part of ASFA that was very significant to all of us, creating the concept of permanency hearings. The federal government requires that at least every 12 months, many states do it more frequently under state law, but at least every 12 months after the child comes into foster care, the agency has to face a court proceeding in which the court is determining whether or not reasonable efforts have been made to achieve permanency, how to get the child out of foster care. You'll see on screen 23 the federal standard and an exception that allows a situation where reasonable efforts are not required. In that situation, a permanency hearing must be held right away. Screen 24 shows you the kinds of circumstances the federal government requires before the court can say reasonable efforts do not have to be made. These are kind of circumstances in which, in essence, the law is saying what has happened here is so serious, the situation is so egregious, it's so unlikely that reunification can occur that we will excuse the agency from making reasonable efforts to do so. You see on page 25 now the reference to that having to happen at least every 12 months. 26 shows who needs to be involved in these permanency hearings. This is federally mandated that these folks must be involved, including that the child and the child's position must be heard by the court. It is not sufficient for the child to simply have someone talking about what's in their best interests. If the child is old enough, mature enough to be able to formulate any kind of position, even though it might be somewhat of a childlike position, then the court must hear that child's position either directly from the child or by someone who represents the child's position, not just best interests. Caretakers and foster parents are entitled to notice an opportunity to be heard. Again, there's some details there about the timing. On screen 27, ASFA mentioned concurrent planning. It did not require it. Some states do have that as part of a mandate in their state law. The federal government simply says in ASFA that they believe concurrent planning is a good idea and would like to see it happen in appropriate cases. Concurrent planning being the idea that although all children in care have one goal, there could be efforts being made toward another permanency goal so that there was concurrent planning and not linear planning, which would save time. I've given you on screen 28 the foster parents' rights regarding permanency hearing. There's not a requirement under federal law that there be a personal appearance by foster parents in permanency hearings, although many state laws require it. And ASFA does not grant foster parents party status, but it certainly makes it very clear that foster parents have a right to be heard and should be given an opportunity to present their position regarding the child's permanency within the concept of permanency hearing. On page 29, you will see the hierarchy of permanency options under ASFA. And again, this all occurred under ASFA, very dramatic when this all happened. All children in foster care have to have one of these five goals, very clearly articulated in both their case plan, in their court proceedings, and in the permanency hearing. The court is permitted to change the permanency option for the child. These are not options for the parent. It's not that there are two goals, one for each parent. There's only one goal for each child, and the court is to be reviewing that goal during the permanency hearing. Is that goal still appropriate? How, you know, much more time do we think till we can achieve that goal? And, you know, is the agency doing what they need to do? page 30 talks about probably what was the most dramatic part of ASFA, the part that caused everyone to really shift their mentality around issues of permanency. The federal government said, kind of, you know, we've had enough of children lingering in foster care, and we are going to pick a time. And although it's not carved in stone, it is certainly drawn, let's say, a line in the sand. And the federal government said petitions to terminate parental rights must be filed if a child has been in foster care for 15 months in a row, or 15 out of the most recent 22 months. Also, if the child has been determined to be abandoned, and again, in a situation in which, because of a felony convictions, the court has been waiving the agency's responsibility to make efforts to reunify. There are large exceptions to this mandate to terminate, obviously. There are many children in foster care for more than 15 months for whom there is not a TPR filed. The exceptions include that the child is out of the home but is with a relative, the federal government feeling that there are other options that could be looked at with relatives. The exception includes that an agency has failed to provide the services that it should. This is not a common exception because, of course, it's the agency that's determining whether or not they have an exception. And rarely would an agency say, document, for example, gee, we haven't done our job by providing services. But the large exception of compelling reasons focuses on the casework aspects from the child's point of view. If the agency believes that being freed for adoption is not the way the case should be resolved, perhaps we're close to reunification with the parent, perhaps we have an older child who's strongly opposing being adopted, perhaps we've found a relative in another state and we're dealing with the dreaded ICPC and it's taking us a while to move the child. We may have lots of reasons why being freed for adoption is not what we think the way the case should go, and the phrase would be used that there's a compelling reason to not file to terminate parental rights. So in essence, ASFA is a presumption that children will start down the pathway to be freed for adoption at 15 months unless one of the exceptions exists. I put compelling reasons there on screen 31 for you. This is also one of those phrases that's used in two different ways. Compelling reasons is a phrase that's used to not file a TPR at 15 out of 22 months, but compelling reason is also a phrase that's used when the goal of another planned permanent living arrangement, APLA, is being selected. It's the default goal, the least of the goals from the point of view of the federal government, and they don't want it chosen for children unless there is no other goal and you feel compelled to choose that. On page 32, I have listed some of the samples that the federal government has given that would be compelling reasons why it's not in the child's best interest at 15 months to file to terminate parental rights. Starting on page 33, I have a few screens here on fostering connections, which is the next major statute that passed in 2008. This statute opened up an option to federally fund what's called kinship guardianship, an option in which the federal government said, we think sometimes there are kin, and they use that term very loosely, doesn't require that the person actually be related, but it requires that it be someone who's connected in some way with the child or family, comes forward, becomes a foster parent for that child, and after it appears as though the child can't return home or for whatever reason doesn't seem like it should be a freed for adoption kind of situation, that this person could take guardianship of this child, raise the child till adulthood while still receiving the same stipend that they would have received as foster parents. And the federal government created the funding stream for that. That's not a mandate, but many, many states chose to do that. Also, fostering connections required that agencies had to aggressively look for all adult relatives within 30 days of removing a children as possible placement alternatives to a foster home that the child was not related to, and that all of those people have to have the option explained to them about what they could do to step forward if they wanted to for this child that they might be connected to, including the option of foster care. Fostering connections, now looking at screen 34, also talked about the fact that the federal government required states to make efforts to keep siblings together. That would include half-siblings as well. And that sibling visitation should be happening at least monthly and assessed on a regular basis. Fostering connection also opened the door to the concept of school stability, requiring that agencies do what they can to try to see if the child can stay in the same school when they are placed in foster care. And fostering connections also required that the agency engage in more elaborate transition planning for older youth who may well be staying in foster care until they age out. In 2014, the next major piece of legislation was the Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act. I like to say PISFA, but I don't hear anybody else saying that. They usually say Preventing Sex Trafficking. This one got into some real nitty-gritty about some of the 4E requirements in court proceedings for child welfare cases. Yes, it certainly was about preventing sex trafficking, and I'll get to that as well. But for those of us practitioners in the courtroom proceedings, it really affected a lot of what happened in our permanency hearings. Looking at screen 36, for example, it had responded to, and I was thrilled about this. I was one of the people that was complaining about this when the kinship guardianship from fostering connections went into play. We discovered that there were situations in which these kinship guardian relatives, oftentimes older relatives, grandparents, great aunts, that kind of thing, decided to become kinship guardian. Then there was a concern that if that person died or became incapacitated, what would happen to that child? There are procedures, for example, if a child is adopted with a subsidy, that if something happens to the adoptive parent, someone can step up for the child and still get the subsidy. It has to be done in certain ways, but it can be done. But some people were not choosing to take the kinship guardianship route, saying there's a worry that this older kin might die or become incapacitated, and then the money needed to raise this child will be gone. So here in PISFA, a federal government responded to that by saying, you know, we will allow in a kinship guardianship, we will allow the kin guardian to name a successor guardian as part of the process with the local district, and that successor guardian can receive the payments if the person named in the kinship guardian assistance agreement originally, as I say, dies or becomes incapacitated. The interesting thing about it was that the federal government said, we will not require that the successor guardian be a person who's related to the child. Also, PISFA tweaked again that placement of children with their siblings and added this very interesting and again, highly technical detail, saying that, you know, we required in fostering connection that you get a hold of all relatives to see whether or not they could be resources when children are being taken out of the home. But now we're going to add to that. We're going to say that includes all adult grandparents. It includes all relatives, but it also includes parents who have legal custody of any siblings or have siblings. Now, that's really fascinating because you could have a situation where perhaps mom's third child is coming into foster care. Where are her other two? Well, maybe her other two are with a daddy who's not the daddy of number three. That means the daddy of one and two has to be notified that a half-sibling to his children is coming into care with the idea of asking him whether or not he might be a caretaker, willing to take this child that he's not related to directly, but that his children are half-sibs to, or put him in a position where he says, well, maybe I can't take that child, but since my children now have a half-sibling, I'd like my children to meet that child. I'd like them to have some visitation. Really fascinating. And they clarified that this included adopted siblings. So again, mom's number three child comes into care. Where's one and two? Oh, they were freed for adoption a few years ago. They're off with a lovely adoptive family. That adoptive family now has to be contacted by the agency and informed that the children they have adopted have a half-sibling who's just come into care, and are they interested in offering themselves as a resource and or having contact, really causing very interesting repercussions, in my opinion, around the concept of confidentiality. This is a lot of people that have to be contacted and told that a child is coming into care. Another fascinating part of PISFA that people are spending a lot of time talking about and is still kind of a hot topic out there in child welfare world is on screen 38, the so-called reasonable and prudent parenting standard, sometimes also referred to as normalcy. This section of the PISFA was really very much driven by older foster children and graduates of the foster care system who spent a lot of time complaining in D.C. and complaining to federal folks about how abnormal their childhood and particularly their teen years were, talking about things like not being allowed to go on sleepover parties, not being allowed to go on vacations with a foster family, not being allowed to participate in sports, really talking about the fact that they weren't allowed to be normal, and that much of this was based on agencies limiting what foster parents were allowed to do with foster children, probably mostly from a liability perspective, and maybe also a little bit from a monetary perspective. So PISFA said, hey, foster parents have to be told that they can engage in the kind of reasonable and prudent parenting of foster children that they engage in with their own children, and that although the foster children's individual situations, their abilities, their concerns, any issues they have to be taken into account, that they should be taken into account just like any child that a parent would consider. Should this child be allowed to play baseball? How about something a little bit more dangerous? Some people are not so keen these days on football, and then they could move into things that are even more dangerous. A hot area in my part of the country is hunting. Should a foster child be allowed to go hunting with a foster family if that's part of what they do? Whitewater rafting. And then there's some, you know, things that are less dangerous but still cause people some alarm. What about participating in prom activities? What about dating? What about birth control? What about being able to use social media? What about all those things that we as parents struggle with, our own children? What ways in which, you know, are foster children different or the same? How will that look? This has resulted in many, many states issuing policies, talking about what should or shouldn't happen. The concept, though, starts under PISFA with the federal government saying, we really need to take a look at this and you really need to figure out what you can do that will allow children to have a more normal life when they are in foster care. It required the states to actually look at caregiver liability to the extent that that was an issue. You know, if the youth wants to learn to drive, and in your state as well as my state, child needs to learn to drive, or they're really not going to be able to function very well, get a part-time job or things like that, then, you know, what happens if the foster parent says, sure, they can learn to drive, but, you know, my car insurance, it'll go up, that the state is required under PISFA to deal with that liability in some way and to help make this not be a reason to say no. The fascinating thing about lawyers and judges and their connection to this reasonable and prudent parenting and normalcy is that they really drug us in to the issue and said it's more than just an issue that the caseworker or the foster family need to have some background in. It's an issue for court by saying that at the permanency hearing of all APLE youth, that would be any youth who has a goal of another planned permanent living arrangement, what we sometimes call a child who's going to be, you know, living in foster care until they can live independently, that at least at those permanency hearings, the court has to specifically ask about whether or not the child is being allowed to do the kinds of things that children of that age are allowed to do, the reasonable and prudent parenting. If you add that to the combo of children at that age now coming more and more physically to the courthouse for their permanency hearings, you have stories out there being talked about in the child welfare world of kids coming to court and asking the judge to give authority for them to, you know, travel out of state with a foster family or pay a certain amount of money for their prom dress, and really bringing the court and the lawyers into the kind of level of detail that I think most of us would think of as being casework. Very interesting area. Looking at screen 39, some of the changes, again, from PISFA in the APLA population. Again, this is our older youth who are being given a goal of another planned permanent living arrangement, essentially a plan for them to stay in care until they're old enough to live out on their own. Court being more and more concerned, and certainly the federal government's being very concerned about what's being done to prepare these youth to live outside of the foster care system so that we are seeing less of our former foster youth in jail or in the homeless population. The first dramatic thing they did is announce that no child, no exceptions, no grandfathering whatsoever, no child could have a goal of APLA until they were 16. This has resulted in a lot of courts asking me questions about what to do with children who are younger, maybe 14, 15, who have no parents to return home to, or parents who've disappeared, parents who are not in any way, shape, or form ever going to be able to care for that child safely, and perhaps no relatives who want to come forward, and maybe a child who opposes the idea of being adopted. What is the goal for that child except APLA? And people struggle with this. The APLA goal may not be given to a child until they are at least 16. At every permanency hearing for an APLA child, the court must have clear documentation of all the intensive ongoing efforts to try to switch back to another goal. So an APLA permanency hearing now is to look quite different than permanency hearings for other children, because here the court is to say, tell me what you've done, agency, to continue to try to see if you could return this child home. Tell me what you've done to continue to see if there's any way to do an adoption or any relatives that might be able to come forward and take guardianship or custody in some way of this child, and that is to happen repeatedly in every permanency hearing until that child ages out. So very dramatic, I think, including, says PISFA, including doing all that the agency can to engage social media, I think they mean Facebook, to try to find family, extended family who might be unaware, for example, that the child is in care and needs a permanent home. Really very dramatic changes in the APLA permanency hearing. On screen 40, APLA youth have to be asked at every permanency hearing, what is your desired permanency outcome? There's not a mandate from the federal government that the youth be physically present, but many, many states are now having youth who have an APLA goal or youth who are over a certain age be present in court to make sure that this is happening. These are requirements of the federal government and could result in loss of money, never mind, of course, believing that it is the right thing to do. The court has to specifically rule why APLA is still the best plan for the child and why the child can't return home, be freed for adoption, or be placed with someone outside of the foster care system. The court has to make a finding that the foster family is using reasonable and prudent parenting in making decisions about what the child is allowed to do or not. The court has to actually talk about the various ongoing opportunities that the child is engaged in. What sort of sports, what sort of after-school activities, part-time jobs, getting a driver's license, being involved in various groups and clubs, all of that is supposed to be being discussed by the court, by the lawyers in the permanency hearing. Looking at screen 41, you'll see that PISFA also took a look at kids who are 14 and up, whether they are APLA kids at 16 or up or not. They said, hey, for all kids who are still in care at 14, we've got lots of things that need to be done, because these could be kids who are headed for a longer stay in foster care, and we want to make sure that we are doing all we can to perhaps be able to achieve permanency without them having to take the APLA route at age 16. The first thing was to require that case plans and transition plans have to be done for children who are 14 and up. Again, that concept being that we could have a child who's maybe headed down the APLA pathway, and that they are to be done in consultation with the child, that the child is to be invited and encouraged to be in service plan type reviews, case reviews. And on top of that, that the child is to be told that they are entitled to bring one or two people of their own selection to attend these meetings. Very interesting, one or two people of their own selection. One of these people can actually be designated as their advocate for reasonable and prudent parenting. Now, I want you to think about this for a minute. I don't know if you can remember being 14. It was a long time ago for me, but I can remember it. Being told at 14 that you're entitled to pick two people who can come with you to case plan reviews with the agency. Who would you pick? Would it be a coach, a teacher, a neighbor, someone who is interested in your well-being, an adult who would try to help and assist, or would it be your best buddy, the guy you're going out with? You know, it's hard to say whether or not a child might choose people that would really be helpful helpful people in that situation. And there is some wiggle room. Federal government said, of course, that it doesn't have to be someone that the agency really thinks is inappropriate and would be using bad judgment for the child. You can imagine who those folks might be. But the fact that the child is choosing people who are not adults is not a reason to say no. One of those people can be designated by the child as being their reasonable and prudent parenting advocate. So perhaps the child would say, I want this to be my, my older friend. Maybe the child's a freshman in high school. I want this to be my friend who's a senior in high school, and they're going to come in and they're going to advocate that I should be allowed to pierce my navel and get some tattoos and go hunting and all kinds of things like that. How aggressively agencies are giving this information to foster children and they're recruiting people to come varies, I think, from state to state when I've gone to talk to people about it, but I certainly have heard some interesting stories. Case plans have to have written descriptions of the transition plan. That was now lowered to age 14. It had been, as you'll recall, a little bit earlier in our PowerPoint here for 16 and up. It's now 14. And that has to be very detailed and has to include a document that gives the child information about their rights. This is a document now that has to be handed to all children who are 14 and up in the foster care system. It's a state design because states vary as to what the child's rights are, but it has to give the child specific details about what their rights are regarding those various things that you see there, education, health, visits, et cetera, and that must be not only given to the child, there must be documentation that it was received by the child has to sign it. And also for all children 14 and older, and this had been at 16, but it was now lowered by PSFA to 14, the agency must do annual credit reports on those children and correct inaccuracies. That might sound odd to you, but apparently there's been documentation that shows that children in foster care often have their identities stolen, and that when they exit foster care, they find out that they have a terrible credit report because someone has been using their name or their identifying details and rung up debt. On screen 42, you'll see, again, more concerns about older children aging out of the system and the requirement that children who are 18 and older who are leaving care and have been in care at least 6 months are to be given their critical paperwork, not copies of it, but their actual paperwork, a certified copy of their birth certificate, so security cards, some sort of state-issued photo ID, the kind of thing that you need to function in and in the adult world with, that is to be obtained and given to them. So earlier than, the last minute, the agency should be working on getting that kind of critical paperwork for the child so that they'll be able to exit with that. Screen 43 does talk about the sex trafficking part of PSFA. You have to have, not been reading the news, I think, for the last 2 years to not realize what a serious problem we have in this country, sex trafficking. And foster children are amongst really very disproportionately found in the sex trafficked population. They are vulnerable youth that are often approached by traffickers. So this sex trafficking portion of PSFA talked about the state having to have very specific policies about what they do when they're investigating CPS cases to see if there could be any sex trafficking involved. Any cases in which the agency is providing help to a family, even if they're not in the foster care system, what they're doing to see if any children could be at risk of that. And any situation, of course, involving foster care, particularly if we have a situation where a child has run away from a foster care situation and is now located, to determine why they ran, whether there was any sex trafficking involved, and reporting that information to law enforcement very quickly. You'll see on screen 44 that I have a long list of the various requirements of local districts, state entities to have protocols regarding locating, running away children who've run out of foster care, and making sure that they are investigating the possibility of sex trafficking as part of what may have happened. Okay, so we're getting to something a little bit more recent, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which went into effect in 2015. ESSA, people will say. So for a long time, people were using McKinney-Bento, that I'm sure you've heard of, as being possibly applicable to foster children, arguing where foster children should go to school. So the ESSA sections that concern foster care, that again passed in 2015, said McKinney-Bento is not applicable any longer for foster children. It is still in existence. It is still applicable for homeless children, but foster children are not to be considered homeless by virtue of the fact that they're in foster care. ESSA says that children who come into foster care should be allowed to return to the school they had been going to if the agency decides that that's in the child's best interest. In other words, ESSA says it's not the court, it's not the school's job to decide where the child should go, that if the child is moved into a foster care situation where they would no longer be in the same school district or would be in the same district but not in the same sort of catchment area for a particular school, that the school had no right to say no to a child who wanted to return if the agency decided that was in the child's best interest. So lots of things have been developed to help agencies sort of determine whether that's a good idea or not for the child. They've indicated under ESSA that transportation of that child, which has been the big fight, frankly, between agencies and schools, the transportation cost of returning a child perhaps some distance to their school of origin, is something that the school and the agency have to reach an agreement on. Some states have just simply issued a law as to who is to pay, but ESSA says the school and the transportation, absent some law, that the transportation issue has to be decided on between the school and the agency. It also requires that the child has to be immediately enrolled in a new school if the choice is to go to a new school, even if there's no records. It's been an ongoing issue around the country where foster children sit home, sometimes weeks on end, and don't get enrolled in a new school because the new school will say, well, we don't have the paperwork from the old school. ESSA says no going there, you have to do it, regardless of the paperwork. ESSA says it's appropriate in determining whether or not it's in the best interest of the child to return to the school, and that it can, that in that analysis, one can consider the transportation time, but not the cost. So, for example, in a state where we're talking about what might be large distances, the fact that a child would have to travel an hour and a half to get back to their old school can be a factor in determining that it's not in their best interest to go back there. But the fact that it would cost a certain amount of money to transport them back there is not supposed to be a factor at all. Immediate enrollment, if they're not going back to the old school, and as I say, that happens without any records, then if the no records have come, it has to happen anyway. And the state has to have a contact person with state ed. Whoever's involved at state ed, there has to be an ESSA person to deal with foster care issues. And it's not supposed to be the same as the McKinney-Bento person, unless you have a situation with very few McKinney-Bento kids. And now we get to the most recent one, Families First. Families First just came down 2018. And again, if you're kind of in the world where you read the things that come through in the child welfare world, you could have seen this. You probably can't have missed it, and you probably wondered, what's this one all about? So this one is frankly about money and financing. And to be perfectly honest, I do not think it's going to have a huge impact on the day-to-day scenario for those of us who are in court in particular. But it will begin to shape some of the landscape, the larger landscape, because when they shift how things are financed, states respond to that. So we may see more availability of preventive programs. That's great. And we may see less problematic issues in congregate care, because those are two things it's focused on. So this does not have, like the list of things I just went through with PISFA, does not have a list of things that will change in court. But it does talk about there being funding for state and foster care agencies, particularly in preventive. And that's a very dramatic thing. 4E funding has generally been focused on foster care costs. This now provides for some funding in certain kinds of programs in a preventive way, which is, it's a pretty dramatic change for the funding situation. It also says congregate care is not going to get paid for unless congregate care looks a certain way. So you'll see on screen 48, for example, that Family First says, hey, we're going to provide some 4E money for programs in specific areas, mental health, substance abuse, parenting skills, in situations where children might be right on the edge, right on the verge, so to speak, of foster care, and that we will provide money. And that's pretty dramatic. That's not something that's happened before. If there is a situation where a child is being placed in a congregate care situation, not a family foster home, then the feds say, we're only going to give you 2 weeks of federal funding unless this congregate care situation meets specific restrictions. And these restrictions have to do with access to medical assistance, with certain kinds of programs being proven to be effective programs. Essentially, the feds are saying, we're not going to be paying for congregate care scenarios anymore unless these congregate care scenarios meet fairly high standards. So that could change the landscape of how things look in your state. Maybe some congregate care situations simply will cease to exist. Maybe others will be dramatically improved. Another family first requirement is that all adults in child care institutions be fingerprinted. And you'll see on screen 49 other things. Families first is a kind of a laundry list. One of the reasons it's sort of confusing to a lot of us is that it just kind of goes on and on with lots of details, saying that there should be electronic ways of passing papers and ICPC. I hope that would help. Talking about foster family licensing and promoting that there be model ways that be done. Asking states to be more aggressive in their policies to reduce the juvenile justice population. Limiting foster homes to just six children. Delay of the adoption delink, if you're familiar with that. That's delinking the subsidy reimbursement by the federal government, delinking it to the income of the birth family, a delay in that. Some revisions on CHAFE, funding for educational resources for older children, and some money for kinship navigator programs. These are programs that help relatives and people that are connected to the child step forward and understand what their options are. I am looking at what appears to be a good 7 or 8 minutes left, and I want to tell you that the rest of my PowerPoint screens focus on two pieces of legislation that are very detailed, and I've given you fairly detailed PowerPoints on them. The first one is the Indian Child Welfare Act, and I know virtually everybody that's listening surely knows ICWA and a lot about ICWA. And, of course, it is dating back from 1978. But the big news that I want to tell you is on screen 52. Again, I'm sure many of you have heard about this. But the big changes in ICWA that have come about are not changes in ICWA itself, but changes mostly due to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June of 2013 on Baby Veronica, which has now led to new regulations in ICWA cases, which do dramatically change the technical details of how an ICWA case progresses. Those regulations have also resulted in a new federal guidance. So what I have for you here is a very, I hope, detailed enough to assist you in reviewing, and I've highlighted for you in these screens what has actually changed in the ICWA area. For my attorneys and judges that might be listening, I would particularly ask you to take a look at the screens and talking about deviations from placement, and also the screen that talks about the need to treat the case as an ICWA case until such time where there is proof that it is not ICWA. Those are the major changes that would really affect day-to-day practice. So if you go all the way through to screen 80, you'll see quite a bit of detail on those modifications to ICWA. ICWA does not impact finances, but ICWA does impact dramatically what happens in our cases that are, in fact, Indian Child Welfare Act cases, and puts us in a position where we have to follow the rules as they're now interpreted under the new regulations, because anyone can petition to invalidate a court order in a child welfare case where there was a violation of the primary sections of ICWA. Starting on screen 81, I've given you a rather detailed analysis of another statute that I would like you to be aware of, the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which passed in 1994 and was modified by the Inter-Ethnic Adoption Provisions of 1996. This is a statute that applies to all children who are not ICWA, all children who are not ICWA. And essentially, at its core, says that race, color, and national origin are not to play a part in deciding where a child will be placed in foster care or where a child will be placed for adoption unless there's something very specific to that child which results in that need, perhaps an older child who has strong feelings, for example. Again, we're down to the last few minutes, so I'm not going to go through the entire set of screens, but I know that there are folks who have a lot of experience with ICWA who maybe have not heard of MIPA, IEPA, and would be helpful for you to take a look at that. It is not different than ICWA. It applies to non-ICWA children. And now we're at screen 91 that says, had enough. There's likely to be more because certainly the federal government has shown its inclination to continue to be involved in the child welfare world by, you know, more and more detail. And I think we will continue to see almost yearly details that will, you know, that we have to stay on top of. I want to repeat again that although all of us in the child welfare world worry about the loss of money, we don't have enough money as it is to take care of the provide the kind of services that we'd like to provide for our children and our families. We don't want to lose money. But in the end, it is important to remember that the federal government, I don't think, is in the business of trying to take money back from us. They're in the business of trying to modify the child welfare system in a way that they think benefits families and children. And they've become more and more technical about it. And this really does require all of us to be carefully monitoring that and understand a little bit about what's behind the requirements so that we are not just technically following them to get the money, but really sort of following the spirit of them. So I'm slowing down here. We've got a few last minutes. I'm wondering if we have questions or people wanted to ask any details about ICWA or MIPA, as I just sort of pointed out the screens to you but did not go over them.
So, Margaret, we don't have any questions in the chat at this moment. I've asked for folks' ideas here. But I had a question for you as you're talking about there's likely to be more. Do you have a sense of kind of where things are trending and what we might see next?
I think that they continue to have more and more permanency concerns and more concerns about older children. I don't think that's gone away, and I think that's the area that we're going to continue to see more work in. More attempts to use the court system, the lawyers and the judges, as sort of the entities that police the agency. And I'm trying to be careful here and not choose words that sound flippant, but if you really look at sort of how they've done things, they sort of started out back in the 70s and the 80s with agencies, you need to do this, states you need to do, social services entities, you need to do this. But they really switched as it moved into the 90s to courts and lawyers, you need to do this to make the agency do that. And I think that that's still the heart of how they see things, that if they keep tweaking what's supposed to happen in court, that the agencies will respond to that. So I suspect to see more of that. They are discouraged that in some states the business of moving children to being freed for adoption is still not going as quickly as they would like it to. But I believe a lot of their attention is now focused on that population that isn't going to be freed for adoption, but is essentially going to age out of care, and what can be done to better prepare them.
Great, thank you. And I'm still not seeing any other questions in the chat.
So maybe people are overwhelmed. There's a lot to read on any of these pieces of legislation. You know, one thing the federal government is very good at is issuing lots of various kinds of informational memoranda and all kinds of detail like that, that if people wanted to get more detail about some of the things that I kind of went over very very quickly, they can definitely get more detail. And I have always offered before, and I will continue to offer, if any practitioner wants to give me a call about any of these things, I'm happy to chat with them. I'm certainly not a Wyoming legal expert, as I'm sure many of your listeners are, but I do know a lot about these federal laws and be willing to weigh in. It's always helpful, I do think, to hear what's going on in some other states, particularly in some of the areas that are not as fleshed out, like the issue of reasonable and prudent parenting, to find out what's going on in other states and get some ideas for what might work might work effectively in your state.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much. We are just about at the end of our time. And I'm not seeing any additional questions. So thank you again, and we appreciate you joining us.
Sure. Glad to talk to everybody, and hopefully I'll see you again sometime in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.